LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Phil Escott, who joins us to discuss alternative approaches to health and healing, including some of the subjects raised in his book Arthritis, The Best Thing That Ever Happened to Me. Modern medicine and mainstream healthcare are minefields of conflicting information and advice, struggling to meet a constant stream of emerging threats and newly diagnosed conditions. For all that the developed and even developing nations are today supposed to be living longer and better than ever, there are worrying trends in an entire constellation of chronic illnesses and a disturbing decline in mental health. From diabetes to cancer, from autism to clinical depression, cases continue to multiply. Despite our scientific and technological sophistication, and in fact in large part because of it, we have created an incredibly toxic environment for ourselves. Beyond pollution of our air and water, a host of other problems, from electromagnetic radiation and artificial light to our schizophrenic relationship with food and fitness, conspire to make us unwell. Factor in societal pressures such as stress around money, work, and relationships, and we find ourselves facing an almost overwhelming assault. And yet questioning received wisdom about health and wellness can be extremely challenging. We live in a system geared towards treating symptoms, not causes, and in which profit all too often comes before people. Cutting through the confusion, however, reveals truths which we have always known, that the human body functions as a single system, mental health is intimately linked to physical well-being, and beyond extreme trauma, the body can heal itself given a genuine chance. Hello and welcome, Phil, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thanks for asking me, Greg.
Today, Phil, we're going to be talking in general about holistic health and healing. You recently published a book entitled Arthritis, The Best Thing That Ever Happened to Me, which will certainly strike some people as a bit strange, but we'll get to an explanation of that in due course. Just before we get started, tell folks a little bit about your background and your work, because your personal story is really very much what comes across in your book, but it's also your way of articulating your ideas about health and healing.
Sure. Well, I guess I've always been interested in health, healing, consciousness, that kind of thing, and the natural way of of healing things. I moved up here to Skelmersdale, where I live now, because of the whole TM crowd thing that I don't have a whole lot to do with anymore, but marvelous phase of my life. And I got interested in health quite early on. I wrote another book back in about 96, and it was about training and lessening the impact of cardio workouts and diet and Ayurveda and that kind of thing. And I realized, well, I only realized after getting very ill that perhaps a lot of it I was on the wrong track about, as a lot of the things I was writing about were actually quite sort of inflammatory foods, if you like, the sort of grains and pulses and things that your average meditating vegetarian is into, that I was so into at the time. And I don't think that did my health any favors. I don't think it was the one thing that pushed it over or anything, but it's interesting how it took an actual debilitating illness for me to really find out what was effective. And that makes me realize that even as somebody who was so interested in natural medicine and holistic living, if you like, myself, I was still, it still took me a long time to defuse the, I'm not sure I've defused all of them yet, but the sort of dogmas that we get stuck with, whether conventional or alternative. And just to be able to have a whole different a viewpoint on health, that listening to your intuition really from moment to moment, and sort of, and another a little a model of what seemed to be good for me was to take everything back to how we were as cavemen, if you like, as Paleolithic humans. I don't know, I couldn't say for absolutely sure anything anymore, but that model seems to work greatly for reversing disease that seems to have come about in the modern world, since we've had an awful lot of disconnects from where we were as wild humans, if you like. And it seems to confuse the body a lot. I mean, it's not just on a dietary level. There's many levels here, you know, emotional, spiritual, all of those, plus all the light cycles, artificial light, EMFs, things like that. The more of this that you cover, and the more that you trick your body, because we can never completely go back, the more you trick your body into thinking perhaps that it's still a hunter-gatherer, if you like, it seems to have a great effect on calming down the immune system, and such a great explosion of autoimmune diseases, cancer, diabetes, all of this sort of thing. And they do seem to calm down. I see an awful lot of results of people fixing themselves, and they do it in this way. So my interest, I think I feel like I spent 3 decades just kind of playing at it until my body finally gave up. And then I was sort of forced to find out what worked and what didn't. So there we go. It's been a kind of long journey through an interest in health, but eventually that's why I would say you mentioned that it was an odd title, that arthritis is the best thing that ever happened to me. It led me to so many places, so many interesting branches of knowledge that I might never have discovered otherwise. And it also helped to fix some of my own sort of complete idiocies, because I think on a healing path, you realize that quite often these things are your own fault on many levels. And you just have to kind of forgive yourself for that, laugh about it, and go on dissecting what an idiot you are on all levels, whether it's something that you eat or a way that you behave or some belief that you have that harms you. And it's been a fascinating journey. So there we are.
Well, we'll get to some of those various levels that you mentioned and break them down individually as we work through. I will just throw out for people something you referred to just when you were starting was TM. I presume you mean transcendental meditation.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
just some people might not know what you were referring to there. Well, yeah, you've alluded to this straight away. One of the first things that occurred to me when reading your book, and it's something that occurs to me a great deal in general, is that in terms of health and healing and nutrition and these other various aspects, the world out there, I mean, there's so much information these days. I mean, many people complain with the internet. We have sort of information overload. And certainly in these areas, we have a sort of a minefield of often conflicting information. I find that we're constantly getting new advice about old problems that quite often is completely contrary to what we had before. And fine, you know, if new information emerges, that's good. Sometimes this new advice, which is contradicting the old advice, is actually in tune with even older ways of doing things. And there's always some seeming new threat. X will give you cancer, Y will give you cancer. And I often think that if you try and bounce around and react and pay attention to all this stuff, you're actually going to make yourself ill just doing that. So, it can be tricky out there for people to find their way, through all this.
Yes. Yes, it can. And it was for me. In the early stages, they say don't Google, you know, don't use Dr. Google and all that. Your GP will often tell you that. Well, my answer is that if you Google for 10 minutes, you'll be terrified and you'll have every ailment under the sun. But if you Google for 12 hours a day for 3 years, certain patterns start to emerge of the things that are really are becoming successful for people in reversing such ailments. And I think the other problem is that one person will say such and such cured them. Say somebody's living a great life in the Mediterranean or something, and they've not got so many EMFs around, and they get this touch of arthritis, and then they give up grains, and they find that it goes away. That's brilliant. But then somebody in the north of England might give up grains, which I always think is probably the number one dietary step anyway. They give up grains and nothing much really happens. Their MS is still there, for example. But in the north of England, we don't have such good circadian biology. We don't have the sunlight. We don't get out in nature. We don't walk around barefoot on next to the ocean. All of these things that make a huge difference that we would have done back then, thousands of years ago. And the more you go south, the more people actually do that, and the more they're out in the sunlight. Also, UV rays from the sun, which were never harmful. This slathering in sun cream is absolutely crazy. They were never harmful. They create great balances of vitamin D, which then allow you to process these carbohydrates, for example. So, you know, when you start to Google and you start to see this is good and this cured this person and this didn't, actually what you have to start looking at is where you are on the planet. What's your own history? What could be your imbalance? If you're somebody who's eating a fantastic diet, you're nothing's wrong with anything, you're emotionally balanced, everything's cool, and yet you're in a basement, your job is in a basement surrounded by computers, artificial light, you know, particularly if you're working nights, that kind of thing is going to push you over. The cancer rates go up hugely among people who work at night. It's to do with the light cycles. It's not to do with disrupted sleep patterns as such. It's to do with the cortisol melatonin cycle and all the problems that come from disrupting that. And so, you know, each person might have something predominantly that's their problem, or a great big mix of all of them. You know, if you're in the north of England in the winter eating bananas that you might think is a health food in the north of England, which it isn't, unless you can pluck it out of a tree, you know, on the equator. All of these truths are not absolute truths. And it sounds incredibly complicated. That makes it sound even more confusing. But actually it isn't in a way. If you just sit there and say, okay, how would I be at this latitude if I didn't have central heating, if I didn't have a roof, if I didn't have all this artificial food with ingredients printed on the side that I can buy at Asda, what would I actually be doing here and now? And you can pretty much piece it together with a bit of common sense. What brought it home to me was really feeling the seasons. About 3 winters ago, I'd come down from something like 15 stone to about 9 stone. I was incredibly skinny. Absolutely no body fat, and I still couldn't get rid of all the inflammation. And I started to get into cold baths over that winter, doing real cold thermogenesis and getting into cold baths and rolling around in the snow. I mean, I was going to fix this thing. I did all sorts of crazy things. A lot of them didn't work, but this one did. And it was to do with just feeling the seasons, and to do with also it resets the hypothalamus via some scientific explanation I can't really remember, and it also reduces inflammation, just like when you put a frozen bag of peas on a sprained ankle or something. If you get in a cold bath, it reduces systemic inflammation. I used to limp into the bathroom, 10 minutes later I'd walk out fine. It just kills it. But it was amazing to actually feel the seasons and sort of trick your body into thinking that it is actually still living out in the wilds, and it's extraordinary what comes together, and just eating natural food as well that might be available at that time. We can never get perfect with that, obviously. The time has gone. So people argue and say, oh, this paleo diet or whatever, you can never actually get back to there. And they're absolutely right. But you can get a lot closer. And if you cut all the sugars and carbohydrates out, getting into ketosis where the body's running on ketones rather than glucose, it's enormous at allowing the gut to heal, reversing inflammation. You know, all these little dodges that you have, because people say, oh, well, of course, it's summer. You wouldn't be in ketosis if you were a Paleolithic man living here or something. And that's true. But these fixes, sometimes when we've broken ourselves, you have to go a little bit further and then kind of come back. So people say, you know, is there something really evil about carbs? No, not at all. If you're living at the equator, they're absolutely fine. If you're an Inuit, you never ate them. It's about what's happening in your own locality at this time of year and depending on your own stressors as well. And we haven't even got into sort of how people spend their whole time in fight or flight because they're worrying about their mortgage or this or that, you know, or they're having an awful marriage or all these stresses that we have in the modern world probably were greatly lessened. You're chased by the occasional animal or you chased an occasional animal and that was pretty much your stressors. But now they're very deep seated and chronic, and all of this stuff creates chronic disease, all of these disconnects. So it's not as simple as just Googling and seeing conflicting advice. Because, for example, a lot of people with autoimmunity or cancer, they say, oh, I got rid of it with Gerson therapy, you know, lots of juicing of vegetables and stuff. Now, I'm undecided on this. I did a lot of that to start with and lost a lot of muscle and ended up ridiculously skinny. It did take away some inflammation, but I found it wasn't sustainable. But people say they've shifted things. I wonder how. Then if you go on to a ketogenic diet, like a sort of high-fat, low-carb thing, it might well help. But again, you see, somebody will maybe get rid of a tumor. 6 months they've been on Gerson therapy or something, and they'll say, this is it, this is what cures cancer. Well, it's confusing because there's also other factors that they're taking away all the grains. They're juicing, so, you know, as long as they're not using too much fruit, they're probably in ketosis anyway, which they could do with a different kind of diet. You see, again, it's all about developing your own intuition and your own common sense, because so many factors have to be taken into account that there's no way they'll ever be able to do a randomized controlled trial. They can do it on each individual thing, I guess, but depending on what other things people are doing, you have to cover so many bases, sort of 50 odd different things or 100 maybe that might be wrong in your lifestyle and in your home to reverse disease. So it's unlikely they'll ever be able to prove it. So we are stuck with anecdotal evidence. We are stuck with piecing it together and experimenting on ourselves. But the fortunate thing is that the things that we experiment with are generally not deadly. You know, they either work or they don't. They don't kill you and blow up your liver like a lot of these modern medications. So it's not really a problem experimenting anyway, and it's also quite fun.
Well, we'll come to some of the stresses that you mentioned there a moment ago. Again, we'll break that down in a little while. Just a couple of brief points based on what you've just been saying. One, with regard to UV, your comment was about certain types of radiation, you know, from the sun never having been harmful. This reminds me of a general point that's worth bearing in mind, you know, with applying common sense here, and, you know, not ploughing on with something that clearly doesn't work. I think everyone understands that if you go out into bright midday sun, depending on your skin type and what you're used to, you know, whereabouts in the world you were born, if you then spend hours and hours and hours in full sun, and I've done it a couple of times and never again, you can be burnt to a crisp.
Oh yeah.
It's not good. Skin cancer is a real thing. They get these malignant melanomas and what have you. So it's, again, it's about applying common sense and looking at your individual situation, your body type, you know, your ethnicity, the whole nine yards.
Our body is equipped with signs to say that you've had enough sun. Mm-hmm. You know, like my girlfriend's from Tanzania, and when we go on holiday, I don't see very much of her because she's black. She can stay out in the sun all day. I get 15 minutes on the first day, and I'm inside again because I won't put sunscreens on because it's becoming more evident. I've got in trouble for saying this, and I've had, you know, a friend even completely blocked me and got very upset about this. And it's understandable at the time because her boyfriend, a friend of mine too, had died of melanoma, gone nuts through his body. But it seems to be coming out more and more in the mainstream now that most sunscreens, that all they do is block the type of UV that tells you that you're burned. It doesn't block the one that gives you cancer, so you're more likely to stay out in the sun long enough for that to give you some kind of problem. But I think it is just common sense. You go out, you sunbathe, and it's fine. Midday, you can get your dosage in quicker. You know, if you have a pale Northern European skin, it can be done very quickly. And, you burn, you know, if you stay out too long. That's the sign. So you're absolutely right. It's nuts to stay out all day and push it. That'll do have no advantage whatsoever. But also, I think sunscreen is along with so many things like medications and stuff, it sort of masks the problem. And I think it's a bit of a bargain with the devil. And I sort of kept quiet about it for a while after I got in trouble. But I started to see this knowledge coming out through people like Mercola, Jack Cruz, you know, that perhaps it wasn't the sort of thing to do, put this sunscreen on. And now you see it coming out more in the mainstream. And I see even sunscreen manufacturers saying, oh, right, well, we've changed this formula because such and such was an irritant anyway, and now this blocks more of the types of UV. Whether it does or not, I have no idea. But clearly it is a concern. So I think twice before slathering yourself or your kids in sunscreen. Just, you know, accept that you've got a Northern European body, as you say, and the fact that you're not going to be able to stay out there all day with your African wife. So I just have to accept that. So, yeah, you're right.
One other little point, just because it's a bit of a personal bugbear with me and something that you said reminded me of this, is in terms of like, you know, working with natural cycles of the climate and natural conditions where you happen to be, whether you're from that part of the world or not. And the thing that gets me is we're speaking here in Great Britain and we've got a temperate climate, but it does get cold. It's rarely warm and sunny for long periods of time. By that, I mean weeks and weeks and weeks. And everywhere you go now, central heating, well, it's been like this for a long time, but I remember growing up in the 1970s not having central heating as such. There was a fire in a grate, and that would, over the course of a day, that might heat the house up in general. You know, the bricks themselves would heat up. But there'd be the extremities of the house could still be very cold. These days, whether I go into shops, supermarkets, other people's homes, not everyone, of course, but most people, the tendency is just to have things, and I can understand why people want it just to be warm and comfortable all the time. But it's like you can almost build up a resistance to, an aversion. You could build up an aversion to any cold whatsoever, to the point where anything less than about, well, it started out maybe 18 degrees centigrade, but then suddenly it's 20 and, oh, 22, you know, it's got to be that all the time. And,
yes,
you know, this is quite achievable in natural ways. Even here in Britain during and most of, you know, Northern Europe during the summer. In the winter, you've got to go to ever more extreme ends to keep things at those sort of temperatures. And then you see people going from that out into the cold and then back into another superheated office, and that constant temperature change. And long story short, I don't think it's particularly healthy, not only to have the extreme changes of temperature, but just to be living in that warm bubble of sort of dust and germs constantly.
Oh, it is. Absolutely. Yes, you can feel all your skin drying out in the winter. You can feel the inflammation coming back in. People get more ill in the winter, so they think there's more bugs flying around. It's not. It's that the immune system is lowered. You get out in the winter. I didn't get any illnesses whatsoever, and there were a load of them flying around that winter when I was out in the cold all the time. I didn't get anything at all. I seldom do now. I still do a little bit of cold thermogenesis, nothing like I used to. But it's living in these artificial environments. Just in the winter here, obviously, we're much more out of tune with the seasons, like you say. And then as somebody goes out and they go, oh, it's cold, a tiny little breath of cool air on their skin, and they go, oh, it's cold out here, I'll put a coat on. That winter, I was purposely taking coats off when we would go out for a walk. You know, I'd sort of look around a bit self-conscious, but then take my top off in the driving rain or something and sleet. And it's actually really exhilarating. Have you seen this guy called Wim Hof? Amazing Dutch guy who went up Everest in a pair of shorts and swam under the polar ice. And he's done some TED Talks and things. He's well worth looking into. Completely rejigged his whole physiology with this and his immune system. They inject him with all kinds of poisons, and then he's there with his breathing and freezing himself in big tanks of ice, and it has no effect on him. Interesting character, you know. He's made this whole cold thermogenesis thing quite popular. But a lot to be said for feeling the seasons, for sure, and getting out of that central heating bubble. You're right.
Now, as I mentioned in my intro, And I just think it's worth reiterating at this point, the sort of conversation we're having here is not by any means to say that mainstream medicine or going to see the doctor or going to your GP or going to see, you know, going to the hospital when you need to or allowing yourself to be referred to a hospital, all of that is somehow useless. It's not about that at all. It's just about what's appropriate and what's best in the situation. Because I know that often when I read articles about what we would call, you know, alternative medicine, some of the modalities we're discussing, there's a very strong pushback, quite often not from specialists, you know, from medical professionals as such, but just from lay people, you know, like myself, who just say, oh, this is all nonsense. I know a woman who got cancer and she drank carrot juice by the gallon and she just turned orange and died. It didn't do her any good sort of thing. You know, you can always find these stories. You can find those in mainstream medicine as well. You can always find horror stories of things going wrong. And that's where this common sense thing that I mentioned earlier comes in. So I think that's a given.
Absolutely,
you know, we're not trying to, and I think you've been very reasonable about this. You've said yourself that you made mistakes. You've indicated there's certain things that you're uncertain about, you're still kind of working with, forming an opinion on. And that's, you know, a good place to be. And I think it's when we start to say hard and fast that, that A or B is the only way you can possibly achieve any health outcome, then you can be into problems.
No, you're absolutely right. This is the thing that a lot of times when I talk like this, and I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because a lot of people say, oh, you're just so against modern medicine. You say, well, no, I'm not. There's miracles in everything, you know. The modern medicine, if I break my leg, I'm going to casualty. I'm not going to sit there and drink herbal tea or do some chanting. It's horses for courses, really. I mean, an oncologist said to me the other week, he said, well, of course, we're good at trauma. I thought, oh, okay. We're not good at chronic stuff, he said. And it's right, because I'm happy to say I'm unsure of stuff. Of course I'm unsure, and I'll always be unsure. As much as I learn, I'll always be unsure about a whole load of stuff, I'm sure. But I think also what you have to look at is the great departments and the great advances in modern medicine, like antibiotics when they're used for life-saving conditions, bacterial infections that are going to kill you otherwise, wonderful. When they're given out for the common cold, ridiculous. But all kinds of things, even low-dose naltrexone, a great dodge that was actually made for heroin addicts that now in very, very low, harmless doses seems to be switching off MS, arthritis, all kinds, but it's not prescribed because it's got buried in the mists of time and patents running out and that kind of thing. there are all kinds of great things in medicine. You know, I mean, with arthritis comes iritis, which is a horrible inflammation of the eye, which can blind you. And I've had that four times during the course of this, and steroid drops in my eyes have saved me. I wouldn't take steroids internally, but as a stopgap to save your eyesight, absolutely fantastic. It's a matter of discrimination and realizing that doctors are not gods. If they would only open up to, because people think it's either alternative or it's conventional. But there's so many grey areas. The diagnostics that they have in hospitals, you know, if you think there's something wrong with you, go to the hospital. Find out what it is. But don't get so frightened, unless it's life-threatening, don't get so frightened that you jump on the treatments. Because if you look at it logically, they don't have any treatments for chronic disease, really. They just don't. You know, the diabetes, they're giving out metformin and telling people to keep their complex carbohydrates up. It's just suicide. You know, type 2 diabetes is very often reversible or at least massively improved by a very, very low carb, high fat diet, ketogenic diet. It's been proved now. There are two doctors, wonderful docs here near where I am. They're based in Southport and they're doing these talks now for other people in the medical community. And another lady in Warrington, and they're doing these talks, food as medicine, because docs don't get training in diet, so they think it's kind of useless. They see one person, like I said, who gives up bread for a week and nothing much happens. But if you really, really nail it, there can be huge, huge differences in chronic disease. So they're doing these great lectures for other doctors to say, listen, wake up. We've only had a couple of days training, and that was the wrong training in all our training as doctors. So come and have a listen to this. And as the doctors wake up, it's brilliant. Now, to me, I think it's a bit funny that people go to the doctors for dietary advice because, you know, the docs didn't have any training. They only have a day or two. And then it's based on the sort of NHS or government eat-well plate, which is quite extraordinary, really, which is full of pasta and sweets and all sorts. So it's difficult for them. But then they wake up. You know, the best docs are saying exactly the same. So I didn't get this from sort of some hippie out there or something. I actually looked at some of the really best docs, like Jack Cruz, Natasha Campbell-McBride, Mark Hyman. There's a whole load of docs out there who've woken up and are saying pretty much this kind of thing. And the practice in Southport here, they've been reducing massively the insulin that they've been giving out to diabetics because basically it's reversing. And that's against the government guidelines. So they're very brave. A lot of them, I think, realize this and then don't have the bottle to do it. But of course, there are absolutely wonderful miracles in modern medicine. But there are something. It's a young science. It's a young science. You know, Ayurveda has been going for centuries, hasn't it? If not millennia, and Chinese medicine and whatever, and our modern medicine here, our allopathic medicine, has not been going really very long. It's still quite a young science, and it's a little bit of a young sort of arrogant upstart. It has some wonderful ideas, but if they would only be open and well, it's happening more anyway, it is, you know, but become open to all these other ideas, both from people who have actually reversed the diseases that they claim to be incurable, and from the practitioners who have been around for a long, long time in their disciplines that have been going back to sort of, you know, BC, I guess. If they could all put their heads together, they'd come up with something really wonderful. I don't have a problem with the medical profession. I do have a bit of a problem with the drug companies. I think they know a lot more than they let on, and I think there is a lot of that is to do with money. I mean, a couple of years ago, they were saying there is no such thing as leaky gut, because the whole leaky gut thing came up, and the balance of bad bacteria to good bacteria in the gut, and then the gut opening up as the wall of the gut becomes, you know, everybody's got Crohn's or IBS or something like that, same kind of thing. And they said, oh, leaky gut doesn't exist. And now they've got a pill to cure leaky gut, which doesn't really work. But, you know, so it's obviously changing. They're starting to realize things, and that there's this huge tidal wave of realization among sort of home scientists, if you like, who are educating themselves. But, yeah, it's a minefield. There is a lot of nonsense out there. I ran into some all sorts of odd info. I did all kinds of things that didn't work. You know, I stripped my body of zinc from drinking too much distilled water when I was convinced that was the answer at one point. And I did do some odd things. That was the only thing that kind of did me any harm. But I took a load of zinc and it came back again. But I completely lost my sense of taste for a while. But still, it was reversible. But yes, it would be nice, because then you can have the people who aren't so gung-ho and do look at it a little bit more rationally from the sort of conventional side, and the mix would be really nice, and I think we would then come up with some wonderful stuff. But will we soon? I don't know.
Well, one objection I hear, you know, you've talked about systems of medicine that have been around for a very long time. One popular objection that I hear is, well, you know, people have never been living longer than they are now. And while that's largely true in many parts of the world, though I would just say there's some evidence, for example, in modern industrial civilizations like North America, that actually our lifespans may not be just extending off into infinity. They might actually be starting to go in the opposite direction. You know, people will say, well, in medieval times, people were living in ditches and eating mud or whatever, and, you know, average lifespan was X, Y, or Z. But there are other reasons for mortality rates and life expectancy and what have you. And so it's not really simple enough to just say, you know, we have certain advantages now, there's no question about that, but it's not just simple enough to say that, you know, because we're living longer, everything's necessarily better, because there are issues with quality of life as well as, you know, length of life. And this is one of the reasons why there's such stress on health service, you know, the National Health Service, for example, here in the UK, is that people are living longer, but they're living longer with chronic disease.
Yeah.
And so again, it's just not this black and white picture.
Well, that's the key for me with this question, which often comes up, that it's about quality of life. It's not so much about length of life. In the West here, we have ways of extending life where people are just on enormous amounts of medication and they're not living a very good existence. And yes, people did quite often die younger because they had more active lifestyles. They were falling out of trees. There was animal attacks, you know, infected wounds. They didn't have any way of sterilizing wounds or, you know, it was different. Also, infant mortality was higher. So that brought down the average hugely. But when you speak about medieval times, I think we'd already messed up there. Because in medieval times, we'd already settled. We'd already started eating grains. There were probably a load of chronic diseases. But still, most of the diseases were because of lack of sanitation and, open sewers running through streets and that kind of thing. So it was pretty. It was more bacterial than the enormous escalation now of heart disease and autoimmunity and chronic diseases. When I think about this sort of picture, I like to look at, say, to take some tribe in the Amazon or something. There's very few hunter-gatherer tribes left, but somebody in the Amazon, they haven't settled yet. They're not really eating that much grain because they've got nothing to mash it up with. If they're eating carbohydrates, it's stuff that's grown locally, root vegetables, tubers. They're killing their local animals, which have eaten what they're supposed to eat in turn. They're physically healthy. They don't have these kind of chronic disease epidemics that we have. They grow up without expectations of like billboards of perfect bodies, things like that, you know, or you have to have this sort of a job and earn this kind of a living. They grow up doing what they've always done for centuries, and they're happy with that, with that position where either there might be a shaman or two in the village, or, you know, who understands about all the herbs, and then the women do their jobs and they forage, and then they take care of the kids and whatever, and the men go out with bows and arrows and go on these great hunts, and back they come, and they know that that's their lifestyle. So it's, they don't constantly pine for something else, which I think is huge. Being out of the present, you know, being in the present and being just so happy with what's happening right at the moment without tremendous worries of the future or stresses from the past is also enormous. So everything they don't have natural light. They don't have electricity out there. I think a lot of the chronic disease came in at the point where electric light came in, because immediately our circadian biology was destroyed. So all of these things, and they still, if they don't meet with accidents, they live fine. They live to ripe old ages. And they have quite often, they have also other things that happen to us, like horrendous tooth decay and stuff like that. They have a lot less of that. You know, it, to me, I would, having experienced a chronic disease, I would much rather go live in the jungle than have that chronic disease back again, put it that way. Before that, people go, oh, well, all the comforts of the modern world, staring at your iPad all the time in bed, you know, and all of these things that they consider luxuries, which are probably more pollutants. It's fine if you haven't yet been in that much agony and thought, right, I'm going to lose my mobility or my life. If you have gone through that and then found some way to fix it, whatever that is, by covering any or all of these areas, you realize that chronic disease and living longer just because you're living in the West and you can be tucked up in a home and be on a drip or whatever is not really something to look forward to. Death isn't something that frightens me, but I'd rather not have any more chronic disease.
Now, one thing that I'm particularly big on that, you know, I just notice a great deal of, when I say big on, I mean sort of vigilant about picking up. I notice this a lot. Is this, and this ties into a number of things that we've been saying, is this a tremendously schizophrenic relationship with food and fitness that we have in industrial nations in the developed West for the most part? That is to say, and you mentioned about billboards, you know, imploring us to be a certain way or to have certain things. Turn on the television now and two of the most popular types of programs are those about food and those about fitness or aspects of body consciousness, you know, fashion, you know, gym, training, whatever it happens to be. And a good place to find this contrast, the schizophrenic contrast, is on those sort of informational channels that are actually sort of adverts. And it's all like cookery programs. This is the latest taste sensation. This is the one ingredient that's, you know, flavor of the month or whatever it happens to be. On the other hand, be slim, look great, get your beach body together. See, can you fit into that, you know, that dress that you were wearing last year? And it's absolutely at polar opposites because, of course, you can be passionate about food. You can love eating and cooking, and you can also have an interest in fitness, you know, how you look and staying in some sort of shape. They're not mutually exclusive, but the net result tends to be when we have these conflicting messages is that people are running around. I mean, it's I think the New Year diet kind of sums it all up, isn't it? People are running around buying all the latest ingredients. So what have I been told to get from Waitrose this week? And then on the other hand, they're sort of lying awake at night. Oh God, you know, I don't even want to switch on the bathroom scales again because I can feel my tummy is expanding, whatever, you know. And it's a very unhealthy sort of way of bouncing from pillar to post.
It is. This is a real. I can't watch programs anymore. The diet programs on the telly. Every now and again, I turn them on. There was one recently which said, oh, maybe the egg and bacon you had for breakfast is actually healthy and the muesli and stuff isn't. So I thought, oh, maybe they're getting somewhere. But that was the only good point in the whole program. And the rest of it, I was just jumping up and down. And I thought, I just don't want to put myself through that stress anymore. You see, I used to own and run a gym. And I did understand about something which a lot of people didn't understand about there was the abbreviated training, that you don't really need to train for very long. You just need to go and zap the body with a little bit of powerlifting moves and then go home and eat and sleep. And this will grow muscle, not hours and hours and hours of repetitive half-assed sets in the gym, which everybody thinks you seem to have to do while drinking all these sugary drinks that just ruin your insulin anyway and make you fat. So the whole concept of this gym thing, I didn't know about really low-carb diets then when I ran the gym, and I wish I had, because I'd have had people looking extraordinary and as a byproduct of being healthy, not as a first line thing. I would have been had some great, very satisfied customers. Now, I only found this out probably in 2010. I got really sick, and then a year later, 2011, after sort of falling ill in the sort of September, October, November of 2010, and then by the summer of 2011. Maybe into the autumn, I couldn't really move. I couldn't exercise. I couldn't do any of the cardio I was doing. I used to ride mountain bikes as well and write for mountain bike mags. And but I still never got lean. And then, sort of, what would I have been then? 49 years old, lying on the sofa, absolutely crippled. And suddenly I was so lean that I had a full-on six-pack and even sort of veins showing in my lower abdomen. I had such little fat, and this was pigging out on quite a lot of calories of fat based meals. And it was extraordinary how insulin obviously completely balanced itself, and so I was burning fat at a tremendous rate, and all of conventional wisdom seemed nonsense. It hit me so much because I was doing no exercise, none at all. And suddenly there I was, incredibly lean and really on the way to recovery as well. So now I see this whole culture of calories in, calories out, you know, burn this off and go to the gym and burn that off. Weight Watchers, Slimming World, they're designed for repeat business as far as I can see. Their dietary advice might, in the short term, if somebody is strict and has some willpower, it might show some results on the scales, but they're not talking about health. They're not feeding their mitochondria. They're not nourishing their cells. They're not getting the nutrients in that they need. You can have a whole meal because it has a certain point system or something. I don't know so much about it, but I understand that all of these things that, you know, you can eat pizza and cake and things. I mean, this isn't food. This is stuff that you can chew and swallow, but it's not really food. And they're encouraged to do that because the focus is totally on weight loss and what you look like. If the focus was on this is how you can eat to full satisfaction because you're designed to, and get lean and reverse disease at the same time. But those guidelines just aren't there. So they get told to go and exercise. Now, Jack Cruise once mentioned a very interesting thing, that you get these programs, like with fat children, that they get sent on boot camps and get forced to exercise. And yes, okay, they'll lose some weight, but they don't want to exercise. It's putting them off. But you see a healthy kid, you can't stop them moving. It's not a matter of getting these kids moving. It's a matter of rebalancing their hormonal cascade of leptin through insulin through, you know, then all the fat storage happens and then they feel lazy. They don't feel like exercising. You need to reverse that, and then the kid will be skinny, and then the kid will just suddenly go running out and start playing football. You don't really need to get grossly overweight kids out and exercising. It'll just put them off. It's 98% of what you look like is done in the kitchen, not in the gym, and not in the way that they tell you. So you're absolutely right. It's an endless treadmill that people go on. When I see the groups like the paleo groups, the low carb, high fat groups and whatever on Facebook, the success stories are absolutely stunning. Every day you see them. Somebody's dropped this, dropped that. You know, we're talking seriously, grossly overweight, 350-pound women and whatever, who are now weighing 150 and they're off all their medications. And they're people who've tried all the Slimming World and Weight Watchers and whatever. And now they just think, well, okay, forget the calories. Forget the exercise until my body wants to move, and let's just rebalance the hormonal system. And you can do that with diet. And light cycles, you'll do it even quicker. You know, the more things you cover, the quicker it'll happen. But it was amazing to me how the body actually reacts and the hormonal system works with fat loss. Because when I started getting into freezing cold baths, I probably actually weighed about 10 stone. I didn't change anything to do with my diet, and then after a couple of months of getting into cold baths, I weighed 9 stone, which was too skinny because I had lost all the muscle. That's not saying anybody should get that skinny at 5'10", which I am. It wasn't that healthy. I weigh 12 stone or so now. But it was extraordinary how the cold actually just completely got rid of the fat. It changes white adipose tissue into brown adipose tissue. It's supposed to be impossible. It actually changes the bad fat into the good fat and strips away what you don't need. There's some extraordinary secrets out there that people just don't know. And if they did know it, there would be far fewer people staring at those billboards and feeling so bad about it, because the focus would be on health, not having a perfect six-pack or whatever that people are after now. That can easily happen from eating really well. But not starving yourself, not pounding away on a treadmill, it's really not the way. We weren't designed for that. This chronic cardio, this is why marathon runners quite often get pretty sick. Their hearts go, they have enlarged hearts, they have open heart surgery, all kinds of things happen, maybe late 30s, early 40s. It's not a good thing. You know, I've been through my period of time looking like a marathon runner. I don't want to look like it again. I'd rather, if I have to do anything, look like a sprinter. Not because I'm obsessed with looking like a sprinter, but because they, to me, look like they're an awful lot healthier. Because we sprinted after an animal. We sprinted away. We wouldn't have jogged all day or see if we could run 100 miles. So the limits of the food that we could have gathered wouldn't really have allowed us to do that. So it's not really, again, in our genetic makeup. So chronic cardio is not really so great for you. The whole system around what you just mentioned is all to cock and keeps people very, very unfulfilled. It's very strange, but the knowledge is coming through. I did see a few things on television recently about sprinting. The doc who often does these programs, I've forgotten his name, but he put some program on about, you know, how much better sprinting is occasionally, maybe a couple of times a week, doing a few sprints, and it only takes you maybe 10 minutes at a time per workout rather than pounding the pavement for hours. So this kind of thing's coming through. It's just putting it all together. And I think when I found the miracles was finding the people who were putting it all together. Like Jack Cruise, like, you know, Natasha Campbell-McBride, like there's a lot of docs out there and people who aren't docs, people coming at it from all kinds of disciplines concerned with this, and then putting the other disciplines together and listening to each other and expanding their knowledge. which I find the conventional diet people and the conventional medical people are not so good at. Once you start listening and pooling ideas, then you get some real results.
Yeah, the sprinting thing does make sense because, as you say, we would have sprinted under certain circumstances, whether after an animal or whether away from an animal,
yeah.
And climbed a tree to save ourselves. But we're kind of designed to walk long distances. That's what we're good at.
Walking's great.
Yeah.
Walking's great, yes. It's that jogging where you've got that sort of middle ground that's continually stressing the system. And for hours and hours, you know, marathon running is a typical kind of thing. It's not good for the human physiology. It's an impressive feat, but it's not good for the human physiology. People even are now experimenting to make it less of an impact. They're experimenting with, running on fats, getting properly fat adapted. And people are doing huge, great 100-mile Alaskan runs and whatever, and only taking water. And they're not doing, the whole gel thing and constantly having to feed their body with carbohydrates because they've become fat adapted. They're in ketosis and they're very efficient fat burners. And it's rare among professional athletes now because it can take a while. And for a normal person, they can start burning fat pretty well and adapt to a fat-based diet within a month or so. But to really get it smoothly running in an athletic arena, they would probably have to miss out on too many competitions and a year's worth of prize money to get it sorted. So very few do, but some are. And the tales of it are quite extraordinary, where they're just taking absolutely no food and just running on their own body fat because they're so efficient at burning it. And that apparently also takes down the impact of doing such long distance, chronic cardio type things. But I just wouldn't risk it really anymore. If I go out I love mountain biking, but I have a different view of it now. I'll not go to a point where I can't breathe through my nose. So it's almost like walking. I'll go really slow. When I come to a downhill, or if I want to specifically do some sprints on the flat, I'll go nuts for it. Or a downhill, I'll have great fun. It's nothing as fun as coming down the side of a mountain on a mountain bike. But just riding around or going up a hill, I used to sort of bust it and think, I have to go as fast as I can. I have to get up this hill. No, now I'll just put it in a granny ring, as it's called, you know, the lowest gear. And I won't go further than I can breathe through my nose. And that takes it down to roughly a kind of heart rate that's no longer so harmful while you're doing those long distance things. So yes, walking all day is great. Walking's fantastic. The more walking you do, the healthier you are. Definitely, it has a huge bearing on longevity and health. If I'm working at the computer, I'll get up and walk around the house. I'll walk up and down the stairs a couple of times. I'll go and bounce on a little mini trampoline. Always break the day up or stand up for a while if I don't actually specifically have to be typing or something. Some people have standing workstations now. All these little dodges to stop the body being just that sedentary. But there is a middle ground. We're very sedentary. We're overweight. We're insulin. We're all sort of borderline diabetic. And then somebody says, oh, you need to go out for a run. You don't. It's the wrong way around. It's putting the cart before the horse.
Can I just ask, and, you know, I don't know, I'm sure you'll have an opinion on this, but I don't know if you've done any research, what you think about this still popular idea of the fat gene, because I thought of this when you mentioned about obese kids being put into boot camps, mainly for the benefit of TV viewers, on these reality shows, because they can all they can all sit at home and feel good about themselves because they're not as overweight as the kids are. I just wondered, because often if I do see an obese child, particularly say if they're not yet, they haven't yet reached puberty, you know, they're younger than that. Very often, if I see them with their parents will be carrying excess weight as well. And I'm just wondering, many people have liked to talk about the idea of there being a fat gene as kind of explaining this. You know, it's a hereditary thing. Other people have poo-pooed it completely and said, well, no, of course, it's what they diet-based. You know, that's the cause of it. It's plain and simple. I just, for my part, anyway, I'm not sure what evolutionary purpose a so-called fat gene would serve. That's all.
Well, I don't know. I think that genetics has been given too much importance. And I think there's an expression, isn't there, that goes around to epigenetics trumps genetics every time, or the map is not the territory. if it, yes, there are certain genetic makeups that tell you what might happen if things go wrong and you mess up. It's like I have something called HLA-B27, which a lot of arthritics have. In fact, most people who have inflammatory arthritis have this gene. And so you initially, you'll believe the doctors. If you don't take it any further than that, you'll believe the doctors. And you'll say, okay, I have this problem with my joints because I have this HLA-B27 antigen or gene or whatever. My science is very sketchy. But really, when you look at it, you find that most people who have this gene don't develop arthritis. So they've obviously, whatever it is that pushes them over into this little thing that says, if you mess up, this is going to go wrong. Now, yes, there are definitely, and I see it too, I see it all over the place. You see whole fat families. What's going on? Well, I don't know. Then again, Jack Cruz, the doc who I keep on coming back to, extraordinary guy. You should have a chat with him sometime. He's a great character, incredibly knowledgeable. But he was 350 pounds, and his kids were fat. But you can restore this. You can just look at everything. Those people might, whether it's genetic or whether it's hormonal primarily, I don't really know. But in families like that, I've also seen great success stories of whole families dropping weight together and getting their health back while dropping the carbs right out, and particularly if they are also taking care of some of the other areas. But so I'd say, yeah, the map is not the territory. It's hard to say, and the theories will go backwards and forwards, but all I'm really knowledgeable about is the levels of different stresses that people have. The actual causes of this, as to why one person will get way fatter than another in the same circumstances, I don't know. You know, you have to look at all the individual stresses on an individual person before you can say exactly what's going on. I think the whole genetic thing is beyond me, but I do see that people with all kinds of genes don't express them if they live well. We all have some kind of genetic marker that says what will go wrong first, whether it's heart disease, MS, cancer, whatever. And I'm sure the genetics have a lot to do with it, but it doesn't have a lot to do with the fact that we will get it, just that we might get it if we cross that boundary.
Well, we're going to come on just now in a moment to, as I mentioned earlier, talk about some of these stresses that we experience, particularly in the modern world, in some detail. But just before I move on, we were talking about obese children there at various points. And in general, we've also talked about diabetes as kind of an exploding condition in our modern age. In general, I've never encountered so many people with some form of diabetes, probably type 2. A couple of people in my family have got it quite late in life, actually. But I also regularly encounter now kids with some form of diabetes. Now, there's going to be a reason for this. It's not kind of just random, but I find it particularly disturbing, although not a parent myself, about how ill younger people and children are getting in greater numbers. Now, there's a whole panoply of kind of conditions here. Diabetes is just one of them, but there's another spectrum of conditions like, you know, the ADHD, for example, and other so-called disorders that they're being generally just prescribed drugs for and told to go away. And it seems to me, again, just speaking from a layman's perspective, that some of these so-called conditions that are being medicated are scarcely conditions at all. Not quite inventing something you then prescribe medication for, but I think probably the classic example for me is so-called restless legs syndrome. you know, if we're never been living longer, and if we have increasing advances in healthcare being made year on year, then logically, you know, we should not be getting sicker in greater numbers. It doesn't make any sense. But say, my particular point I want to draw out in all of that is just about kids getting sicker. And it's always something that I associated with diabetes in particular. If I even knew what that was decades ago, I just assumed it was something that old people would have.
Yes. Well, I think the problem here is we know that diabetes comes from you know, too much, a diet that's too high in sugars and carbs. But why a huge explosion now? Because we've been eating quite a lot of sugars and carbs since, you know, 70s or so. I think, as far as I can see, from the people who seem to have put it together, we have an enormous amount of stress now from EMFs. It goes up and up and up. The G ratings go up on phones. As they go up, they become more damaging. Mobile phone masks going up all over the place. you've got to look at the work also of Natasha Campbell-McBride. She's great. She's a Russian-trained neurosurgeon and neurologist. And her claim to fame is having cured her own kid of autism from, you know, very, very low carbohydrate diet, bone broths to rebuild the gut, probiotics, fermented foods. The link between the gut and the brain is enormous. We have the GALT, the gut-associated lymphoid tissue. We have pretty much another brain that runs alongside our guts. So why on earth would our emotions not be very much tied to our gut health? And you can find enormous success with kids' behavior. You know, these behavioral disorders that go through all the way in the spectrum from attention deficit disorder through Asperger's and into autism. When you fix the gut, there's great success people are having with this. as for why so early, I think it is the multiplication of stressors. I mean, I only read this morning that when I was looking into this whole business of the bees dying, and then most people blame it on pesticides. But why suddenly has it increased so much? So many bees getting wiped out. It's, and some people say, okay, well, it's nothing to do with the pesticides. What it is all the mobile phones. It's all the, you know, it ruins their navigation systems. You put a house phone, a cordless house phone next to a hive, and they can't find their way back, that kind of thing. But I think something that I saw this morning was quite interesting, that the EMFs, they break down or make it possible for these pesticides to cross the blood-brain barrier. So the bees become much more susceptible because of another thing. So again, it's a multifaceted approach that's needed to get rid of these problems. And it's not just one thing that's causing it. It's not one thing that's causing these kids to get so diabetic, so fat so early. It's the sedentary lifestyles. It's the constantly staring at screens. It's being given mobile phones at that age, which are so much more harmful to a kid than they are to an adult, where they're bad enough anyway. So these kids are constantly using their mobile phones. They're up at night texting. They're up at night on their tablets playing Pokemon or whatever goes on. And all of these things combined with these ridiculous foods that they, these sort of blue drinks and fruit shoots, and my God, you know, you look at them and you wonder that the human body lasts so long, not that there's so many outbreaks of these things. And most of what they eat all day long, they'll wake up and they'll have some kind of cereal for breakfast, and then they'll have sandwiches for lunch, and then they'll get home in the evening and they'll have chips or pasta. This is not really, there's not really any nourishment in any of that, and it's completely destroying the balance of your gut flora and upsetting insulin. It's all based on sugars, this weird thing that brown bread is healthy, you know, wholemeal bread or something. It's nonsense. And so the combination of all of this, I think, is making it happen to kids that are much younger and making it, you know, even people who are quite, you say, you know, your relatives, some of them are starting off with these sort of ailments later on in life. Well, it happened with me. I noticed that I had a propensity for painful joints, and I was very boiling hot. I had inflammation. I definitely had inflammation running for a good 15 years before it actually really went nuts in 2010. But from 2006, I was living in a bath of EMFs. I was in a band that used projectors and computers, and I was using an electronic drum kit, and we were projecting videos and constantly, even in our rehearsal room, even when I was sitting there and doing some other work, I had lights and scanners going on and Wi-Fi backups for the computers running all the time. We had some guy came in and checked us out for levels of Wi-Fi, and he said, "My God, it's terrible in here. How do you even live in here?" And that was somebody who was just checked for it, wasn't really fully up on the health problems. But that probably pushed me over to the edge into the full-blown autoimmunity in 2010. The body is actually quite resilient against these things. But I think there you go. It's the escalation of all of these pollutants in all forms that's making the older people get the type 2 diabetes and the younger ones get obese and stray into type 2 diabetes and autism and whatever too. And then there's the vaccination question. I don't really like to get into that because I don't know. There's very strong arguments on both sides, but there's no smoke without fire. Some awful things have happened from vaccinations. Do they cause autism on their own? Probably not. Probably as a factor when you add them into everything else, then they might be the last straw. But again, I don't know. But I, you know, all I can say is personally, I wouldn't give my kids any vaccinations. And they're not. I've got a 1-year-old and a 7-year-old, and they won't have any. And my 7-year-old is the healthiest kid that I can see in the school. She's hardly ever off. She doesn't get the stuff that other kids get. They're always on antibiotics. They're kind of obese. She eats her fair share of rubbish because you can't help it. They even dole it out at schools. They come home with Haribo every day. But when she's here, you know, there's no bread in the house. There's no, well, she'll live on a very fatty diet, a very high fat, meat and egg and fish based diet, that, and she's so lean and muscular, and she looks amazing. So, you know, it's certainly not the high fat, because she probably eats more butter than any other kid in school. But they're eating all the grains and carbs and playing a lot more on their tablets. She's at the age where she started shouting for a mobile phone, and she's not getting one because you can see what they do. So, yeah. Long-winded answer. Escalation of everything all at once. That's what's going on.
Well, to some degree, as far as vaccines go, it's horses for courses. You know, as you say, it's a holistic picture. It's something we keep going back to. And what will affect one person may not affect another. Or a vaccine or a combination of vaccines may be enough to just tip someone over into some sort of illness that, you know, wouldn't have happened otherwise. And, of course, vaccines may be enough to prevent someone from tipping over into illness that they might otherwise have done, depending on other factors. But I mean, it's like a corn, for example. I don't eat corn as such, but I have eaten it in the past. I can eat it, don't have a problem with it. I mention this because I've got a friend who, if he eats corn, will go almost literally green and just eject substances from every orifice, you know. He just can't. Anyway, he'll be really, really rather ill to the point where
You're talking about corn, not corn. The stuff that Mo Farah advertises on the telly, right?
Yeah, corn. Yeah.
I bet he never eats it.
Yeah.
but yeah, they're awful stuff. Yes, a dreadful processed food sold under the banner of health food. Very strange, yes.
Just another thing to add to the glossary here as we go along. You mentioned EMFs. Just again, for people who don't know, you're talking about electromagnetic field.
Yes. Anything that's created from electricity or devices or Wi-Fi or whatever in your house. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's increasingly difficult to get away from any of that, isn't it?
It is. And where I'm going to be very interested to see how these things escalate when they put smart meters on people's houses widely. I think there'll be another escalation. Those things are awful. So, you know, you're right. It could be something that just pushes somebody over into something. But I think it would be nice to see, instead of this whole culture of vaccinations, this sort of preventative thing, rather than be focused on strengthening people's immune systems. Because I saw another interesting thing the other day that, you know, with the early days of the smallpox vaccine, when it was a politician, or was it a very well-known doctor? Anyway, he said, oh, this is so safe, and vaccinated his own grandkids publicly on telly. Anyway, the boy, I believe, died a day later, and the girl was polio. And the girl actually developed polio and was crippled for life. So that was from the vaccine. So they're not all to, there's all sorts of odd things going on there with the vaccinations. Maybe they've got them better now, but it would be nice to see a strengthening of immune systems. People are always going to come down with something, but we always have to meddle on that kind of level. I look at us now, who we hardly ever get sick here, when I used to a lot, when I used to eat differently. My daughter, she hardly ever gets sick. If she gets sick, it's usually a stomach upset when she's managed to get her hands on a pizza or something. It's not really a chronic thing here that people get ill. Now, will she come down with something that she's not been vaccinated for? Okay, it's in the back of my mind. But these days, it's like a 1% worry. Whereas I've got a 99% confidence that the thing that we're doing now to strengthen her immune system is more valuable than a vaccination that you could give. And judging by the kids at school and the amount that they're ill, and my daughter had a 100% attendance record last term. So I think we're on the right track. I feel kind of confident we're on the right track in strengthening immune system rather than bunging in a load of stuff to try and make the body produce the right antibodies. Because we don't know what we're doing there, really. We don't quite know what we're doing.
Now, you mentioned antibiotics in the context of your daughter's schoolmates, many of them being prescribed them. This is actually one of the main tools in the armory of modern medicine that's actually beginning to get into difficulties.
Yes.
Because they're so widely prescribed now, and we're getting more and more antibiotic-resistant bacteria and what have you. And even absolutely mainstream medical professionals now, some of them are going on record and saying they're extremely concerned about what future decades hold in this field. And it's simply because it got to the point where, for doctors, forget the fact that the companies manufacturing the antibiotics want to shift as many units as possible, but for many doctors are getting pressure from patients who are coming in to see them and saying, oh, this, that, I've got pain here, this is wrong, that's wrong. Doctor checks them out, okay. And antibiotics could be the go-to thing. But in many cases, just masking symptoms, not actually dealing with the problem. But yeah, just in general, the antibiotic-resistant thing is going to be a major problem unless they come up with some other miracle, because it is the one thing in its various forms that is used to just throw at so many things and kind of keep a lid on them. And if that's no longer working, well, who knows what the future is going to look like.
Yeah, again, a rethink here would be brilliant, because they're looking at bad bacteria in the system causing a problem. Let's not get into when they prescribe them for viral infections, which is absolutely useless. But when they're prescribing for some bacterial thing that it even might be useful for, it's also killing the good stuff and rearranging the balance, the delicate balance. So it's a short-term thing. Now, there's a new technique coming up in the NHS where they're doing fecal implants, where they're actually getting healthy turds from people and putting them into the digestive systems of people with ulcerative colitis and IBS and Crohn's, things like that. And they're having fantastic results from it because it's rebalancing the bacteria. So instead of wiping things out, sort of going in with a machine gun, rather sort of go in with a whole load of good guys to crowd out the bad guys. It's a much safer approach. It allows nature to rebalance itself. And it looks to be the way forward to me. Probiotics are huge, although most of them are useless. But the theory is very good. If you ferment your own cabbage and make sauerkraut, you could get trillions of cultures of beneficial bacteria per forkful, rather than the 50 billion in one capsule that might be dead when you buy them expensively from the health food shop. So there's cheap ways around it. This fecal implant thing is huge. If they would only realize about the balance of bacteria and take that fecal implant thing to the rheumatology department, for example, or to endocrinology, and just see how many other things it would balance. Because rebalancing the gut flora was huge in taking down inflammation in my body and stopping the immune system being so confused. So, but the trouble is the hospital splits things up into departments. If it does catch on in gastroenterology, it's going to be a hell of a long time before they associate it with rheumatology. But it would be, all health begins in the gut. It does. It all systems of medicine have said this up until now. And now I think even our modern medicine is running out of ideas, and they're starting to realize the importance of the balance of bacteria. So, yes, and hopefully once they start on that, they will come up with huge things. But the trouble is, for the drug company, it's very difficult to patent a turd. So,
well, I think some people have definitely tried to do that.
So they'll have difficulties. I have heard, though, you know, I mean, the amazing results that people are having with cannabis oil these days, and now they've patented a GMO version of cannabis so that they can now control it and make it legal. And I did a massive face palm yesterday when I saw that one. I thought, oh my God. But that's what's happening on the cannabis front as well, which is extraordinary. So.
Well, that's a whole area in itself, isn't it, to get into, whether medicinal or recreational or whatever. But just briefly, I'm going to ask you about sauerkraut because I absolutely love sauerkraut. Now, I've never made it, but I will buy jars of it. Is the stuff I buy in jars that seems to be, you know, perfectly good quality? It's Polish. It's one of the advantages of the Polish immigration wave is that you can now buy these things in Sainsbury's. Is that likely to be useless from a...
Yes, usually, because they've pasteurized it.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. So then, you know, this great paranoia. Yesterday was our sort of monthly or two-weekly trip up to a farm nearby to get unpasteurized milk. I don't drink milk. I don't think the milk part of dairy is very good. It's the carbs from the cow. I prefer cheese and cream and the high fat stuff, which seems to be more beneficial, full of vitamin K and doesn't really unbalance insulin like the milk does. But once you pasteurize it, it's useless because they wiped out the lactase that helps you digest the lactose. So everybody's lactose intolerant. Setting aside the fact that it's probably a bit funny drinking the milk of another species anyway. My little boy who's just been weaned, he's gone on to milk now and again, you know, have it sort of warmed up, watered down. But when my daughter, who's seven now, when she was weaned at the same stage, we put her on ordinary milk, and immediately she came out in eczema all over. And we didn't stop the milk. We just went and got unpasteurized stuff, and within 3 days, the eczema cleared up, and it never came back. And so this is the same thing. We always have to mess about with something, this paranoia about TB. And so everything needs to be pasteurized, which causes far more health problems. So as for sauerkraut, it's difficult to find the unpasteurized stuff because there's all these regulations in supermarkets. To give them a plug, there's a site called Red23 online, and they do some great stuff that's unpasteurized, absolutely delicious, and kimchis and vegetable medleys and God knows what. They've got all kinds of probiotic stuff on there that's really good. That's what I do when we can't be asked to make it. But you can make your own very simply just with chopped up organic cabbage and maybe a little bit of extra filtered water if you need it and some Himalayan salt. And you're done. You leave it to ferment and you've got tremendous probiotics. But it is a bit of a pain, I suppose, to start with. But Red23, I can vouch for them. I don't know who else definitely has unpasteurized stuff, but that place is good if anybody's looking for that and they're going to the Polish shops. I've looked in the Polish shops and sometimes it doesn't say whether it is or whether it isn't, so I'm not sure. So I haven't taken the chance. I mean, I bought a couple of jars of it. It's quite nice, but I haven't. It's not as nice as the Red23 stuff. But I couldn't swear if it's pasteurized or not. But just to be safe, if you're using it as a medicine anyway, don't put your faith in supermarket sauerkraut. It's probably ruined.
Okay. Well, I'll look into the alternatives then. Now, as we kind of move into the final phase of our discussion, Phil, we'll get into some stuff here that really is in the final part of your book. And, you know, we've talked about different stressors, environmental stressors. We've talked about all sorts of physical ones, things we do to ourselves, have done to us. But there's this psychological aspect to it. For example, one way of characterizing this might be the quality of our relationships, you know, how happy we are with our other life circumstances, or in our work, you know, our attitude to money, if we're under stress there, the general pace of life, all of which boiling down to how our emotional health and mental health and where those are at. And it's, for me, it's always been very, very clear that your mental health can affect your physical health. You see people, for example, who are suffering from depression, who may be, if not ill, physically ill as such, they may be, you know, physically, how can I put it, underperforming, you know, a lot less healthy than they could otherwise be, maybe simply because they're not looking after themselves. But it, beyond that, you can see the whole thing about positive attitude when it comes to healing. And people get very glib about this and they say, oh, well, think positive. Yeah, right. That's going to help if you've got cancer. But actually, The evidence suggests that it does. So this is a huge part for me, and I'd sum it up as a kind of the mind-body relationship. And it's very, very important when it comes to all the things we're talking about.
I think it completely trumps everything we've just talked about. What I like about the stuff that we've just talked about is that it leads people in to a bit of the magic in something that they can kind of grasp the concept of. If you get somebody who's really ill, that's why I put it in the third part of the book. The first part of the book was all of suffering and stuff, because you've got to identify with people and show you have actually been there. If I just came jumping in and go, wow, I feel better than I ever did in my whole life. In fact, I don't particularly exist anymore, because you can realize the unity of all things and blah, they switch off. And understandably so. I mean, I looked into this kind of thing even in the early days of my illness, but I'd been interested in it all my life. I've been absolutely fascinated with consciousness more than anything else. What is it? What are these higher states of consciousness? What do they mean? And then when I got ill, I'd had a great shift in consciousness about 2005, 2006. And then I thought, oh no, I've lost it. What's happened? It's all gone awful. How can I possibly then be this ill? But actually, a lot of these things are growing pains, and if you treat them right and don't cover up the symptoms, they can take you to some wonderful, wonderful places. I remember lying in the bath reading a book by the guy who did all that liver flushing book. What's his name? Andreas Moritz. And he was talking about the acceptance of illness and not fighting it, and how it's a really useful thing to have happen to you. And when its time with you is over, it will leave you. And even for me, this was a bit airy-fairy. I was thinking, I hope so. I hope so, but please go away. And I'm sort of fighting the illness and being unhappy with it. Instead, there's a point you can get to where you just say, well, okay, I've got to find a way to be really happy and content, even if I never get rid of this. Because if I'm always wishing it away, I can't possibly be happy. If I'm thinking my joints hurt, I can't stand it, go away, leave me alone. You can't take it. Now, all the protocols of freezing yourself and eating a ketogenic diet and getting sunlight and all that kind of thing, they're brilliant for bringing down the symptoms, but they usually don't actually get rid of it completely. They bring the symptoms down. And I noticed what's so fascinating about arthritis is, as various different emotional things or false beliefs or stresses in the way of things that you worry about or things that you've carried stresses with for years, maybe since childhood, as you use various techniques to unwind those, individual joints can heal up, bang, totally. And you can tell, you know, if you're on all these protocols like ketogenic diet and wearing the orange shades at night so you have no blue light coming in, maybe even taking low-dose naltrexone, all these harmless things to bring down the symptoms, you can still listen to the whispers and not be quite so panicked. But suddenly one joint will just go pop, or two corresponding joints, like for me, both ankles, for example, the first ones that completely healed, was to do with being in a situation that I hated, that I really wanted to run away from, being in a house with my mother, my 90-plus-year-old mother, who was very difficult to live with. And I'd kind of put myself in this situation where I was being her carer, but I realized I could do it from a distance. And the whole attitude changed, and suddenly as we split up and put her in her own place and we got our own place, suddenly the ankles healed. And it was extraordinary to me. And I've seen it happen with other areas of the body. Even sections of the spine that were affected have healed up due to different emotional imbalances being addressed. Now, what am I talking about, emotional imbalances? It's a very subtle thing. And some people look at these books like Byron Katie's techniques, The Work, which are marvelous. Her website, thework.com, is a huge entrance to a massive rabbit hole of knowledge of this. The emotional freedom technique, very many techniques out there, whichever you find the most attractive, can unwind these things. But the technique is, the secret is to just do it hundreds of times a day. You know, you do it once or twice, it won't work. But what do you look for? I spent 2 years not even knowing what to do. I read some of these books and I thought, what do I look for? It's not about digging into your childhood. Oh, yeah, you know, I was beaten by this headmaster, or my parents sent me to boarding school, or this person said this awful thing to me when I was a kid, and it's grown into this horrendous stress about the size of my arse, or whatever it is, you know, that you've got. So it's about saying, what's the problem in the present? And when we realize that the present is the place to be, even for diagnosis, you're sitting there, and whatever problem that you're worried about right now is probably the thing that you need to work on. Plus, it's the thing that's probably causing a major physical symptom. So instead of digging into childhood, just go, well, what's happening here? Okay, well, I'm a little bit upset about such and such. I'm worried about this money business, these bills or whatever. So what's caused that? Then I look back into childhood at a time when somebody told me, okay, well, maybe you weren't any good and you were never going to earn any money and you'll, whatever it is. Sometimes these things lead you back organically into childhood. Don't try and dig. Just see what it is that's here. Or maybe you started some business and it failed, and since then you've been very frightened and you're frightened to dip your toe in again. Or I'm only guessing, you know, it could be anything. It could be a stress about how you don't get on with your sister and how the relationship broke down and how it stresses you out every day that you miss them and you want to apologize or something because of some false belief or some ridiculous family feud that happened. Any of these stresses could happen, sort of sexual inadequacies, you know. All the things that are very strong in our minds, as strong human drives, can also be misinterpreted by the mind. The mind doesn't really distinguish between fact and fantasy a lot of the time, and we create these fantasies. Most of what we walk around with are just ideas and concepts that we've learned from books, from other people, from school. They're not necessarily true. Nothing we believe at all, even the stuff that I've been talking about, I don't think it's necessarily gospel truths. It's the best I can do at the moment for telling people how to reduce the symptoms of their diseases. That's all I can say for sure. There might be something found at some point that trumps all of this kind of thing, and I'll be happy with that. That's great. I'm not attached to my points of view. And I have been many times in my life, although now people still see the old Phil going on about ketogenic diets and life cycles. He's always blathering on. He's really attached. I'm not attached to those views. They seem to be incredibly useful. But if I find something more useful, I'm very happy to let those go. It's about letting concepts go, becoming more fluid, becoming less stuck in your own emotions and the pain of your own emotions. It's a very, very difficult journey to actually talk about, because that now is so individual. My advice to anybody who wants to look at this is to start to look at some videos of people working on other people with EFT. Maybe see how Byron Katie works. She's amazing when she sits down with people and starts to pick apart their false beliefs that have been causing them such stress all their lives. The techniques that she uses for that, that you can do on yourself so easily. And then it's an interesting point, actually, because for decades I was a meditator, being sort of chasing this these higher states of consciousness and this bliss and whatever. But actually what did it for me more in the end was being sick and being forced to look at these emotional imbalances. And it's interesting, as you zap these emotional imbalances one by one, it's almost like clouds covering a blue sky. You realize what was there already. Instead of chasing it but not seeing it and staring through a telescope and freaking out that you can't see the blue sky through the clouds, if you just zap those clouds one at a time, suddenly you start to see blue sky, and then you have the confidence, even if clouds come, they're no big deal. You know, now a problem comes, I don't have the panic I used to have, because we never get rid of problems. That's life. But when a problem comes now, it's like, oh dear, but ooh, that's interesting. I wonder where that's leading, because what am I going to learn from it? It's going to have a silver lining. There's no question. And once you start to look at life like that, it's extraordinary how things clear up. At the moment when I decided, and absolutely decided, because it's you can fake it, but there is a point where you just have had enough and you surrender and you say, just, okay, let's relax into what this illness is trying to tell me. And I'm going to be happy despite the fact that this might stay for the rest of my life. At that point was the biggest upward curve of healing. when I actually accepted the illness. What you resist persists. A very subtle thing, very difficult to talk about in such a short interview. You know, if I talk about this to somebody for 2 hours, in person, we might start to scratch the surface for their own particular case, and then it's for them to use their intuition to move forwards. But it's massive in healing, absolutely massive. You were saying early on, this thing gives you cancer, that thing gives you cancer. They're all saying on the news. Wonderful woman who I would recommend they looked into. If anyone's listening to this, for example, who has cancer, go and look at thetruthaboutcancer.com. All the videos on there of the people who fixed it. It's extraordinary. And oncologists who are waking up and saying, listen, chemo isn't really the way to go. But Anita Morjani, she's a wonderful woman. She had she was so close to death, tumors riddling her body. 2 days later, she was in a coma, all the relatives gathering. 2 days later, she was awake, and a few weeks later, no tumors. What happened? Her story is fantastic. Lots of interviews with her out there. And when she was asked in one of the interviews I was listening to, what do you think is the main thing that's causing this epidemic of cancer? She said fear of cancer. And it is. How many people get diagnosed and then they're dead in 2 weeks? They say, oh, you've got 6 months to live, and they're dead in 2 weeks. Okay, the chemo gets them a lot, but quite often the fear does before the chemo even has a chance. And they probably had this cancer for about 8 years, 5 to 8 years before it gets diagnosed. So, you know, what is it that's going on? The placebo effect. The placebo effect is probably the greatest thing in healing. And they cast it aside, the conventional medicine. Oh, it's just placebo effect. They healed. Great. That's fantastic. That is the best healer. It's when you get yourself to a state where spontaneous healing is possible, and we call it a miracle, but it isn't really. You can do that, but like Jack Cruz says, all of these protocols of freezing yourself, of sorting out light cycles and diet and whatever, is really just slowing down the process. To actually nail it, you need to take away all the stresses, and most of the stresses are self-created in us. They're the demons within us. And illness gives you such an opportunity to look at these things, whereas modern medicine just covers up the symptoms and that's it, off you go, at the expense of probably blowing up your liver and detaching your retina and whatever these other autoimmune medications do to you. But to me, being able to listen to the symptoms, doing all you can to bring them down, but then the wonderful and fascinating process of disassembling your own false notions about stuff, your own false beliefs and stresses. You don't need detective films. You don't need to be staring at the telly when you've got that to do. It's a really fascinating journey, and that is the real crux of healing. Absolutely.
The mind suffers and the body cries out, as they say, and most of this suffering, as you just pointed out, doesn't need to be happening at all. It's self-inflicted, or it's coming from a source that we can choose to accept or otherwise. I mean, I think my closing thought, perhaps, to add to what you said would be, we have this tremendous identification with our bodies. For many people, that is who we are. You know, yes, we're a personality, but our body is the incarnation of this. It's the vehicle for our consciousness, and defines who we are in many ways. And tied to that is terrible fear of death. And you can see that, of course, if someone...
All fear is rooted in a fear of death. You nailed it.
Yeah, exactly. And this has a huge effect on how we live. And I've just been doing a lot of recent reading on near-death experiences and what people are saying, people who've experienced those. And they seem to be almost, 100% of them are saying, lose this fear of death and you can learn to really live.
Yeah,
because death isn't what it seems to be, or what it appears to be, or what we're told it is. And as we've been saying all the way through, people are trying to cling to a particular way of being physically. And, the human body is designed to last. It seems to have a certain average span. Thus far, we haven't got anyone amongst us who's 500 years old or 1,000 years old. The physical deterioration is just part of using it like any piece of machinery. You can look after your car as long as you like, for example, but at some point it may just give up the ghost, so to speak.
And this, where all of that emotional work leads, is this is why I like Byron Katie so much, because a lot of people have jumped on the back and done these kind of emotional work, but she actually had a proper awakening to her essential nature, And that's what she's basing this stuff on, which makes it so much more powerful. And it leads people to that, because as the clouds disappear over the blue sky, you realize that the blue sky really, figuratively, is just the screen that life is projected on, which is our essential nature, where we really are just one organism. And this was what brought Anita Morjani back from minutes from death, maybe. She had this huge awakening experience where she was not particularly inhabiting her body as such anymore, although she knew what was going on in the room when they thought she was in a coma. But she had this awakening and then chose to come back into the body. And this is what it can lead you to. You know, it can lead you to a real understanding of what our essential nature is. And when you have that understanding, that actual first-hand experience of it, you can't take things so seriously anymore. The stuff that happens to you, the stresses that would normally freak out most people, whether it's an illness or whether it's sort of financial problems or whatever, they become a little bit of a joke in the perspective. And then people say, oh yes, but then you don't care and you don't do anything. That's another misconception. You don't. There are times if you have some really profound awakening that people do sit and stare into the middle distance for a couple of years. Eckhart Tolle, Byron Katie, Ramana Maharshi. I mean, he sat around in a cave for 26 odd years before he talked about it, and he's sort of among yogic circles claimed to be the great master of all of this whole non-duality and stuff now, one of the greatest gurus ever. But, you know, people do get disorientated, but eventually, no, it makes you more dynamic, because you realize that there is no beyond. There is no higher state of consciousness. There's just consciousness, and there's just life. And this is it right now. We're like somebody said, I think, fish swimming around in the ocean looking for the water. It was here all the time. The miracle was here all the time. And yet we're so dissatisfied with everything, which brings me back to the guy there in the tribe in the Amazon or whatever. He's happy with what's going on, and they understand their whole relationship to nature and their connection with the animals, with the plants, with the seasons, with everything. You know, it's also our connection with each other, our connection with EMFs, our connection with everything. It's all God, if you like. Not that I see God as a separate entity, but I see, you know, sort of the universe, God, the unified field, as quantum physicists call it, whatever it is there that is the lowest common factor that makes up all of us as that great big field, that one organism. When you start to get a sense of that and not reside so much in the body thinking, this is me, I am this collection of cells, you can step back from any of this. And even if the disease goes on, probably at a greatly lessened rate, having taken into account all the other protocols that you might do, then it won't seem so serious to you. It just won't, because it's just, oh, there's an interesting thing going on. I often say that if you're watching a film and somebody gets up in the morning, they have breakfast, they go to work, they come home and they have a little chat with their missus and then they go to sleep, it's a very boring film. But that's what we kind of want. We want that stable lifestyle. But life isn't like that. A really good film, it has all kinds of things. Car chases, decapitations, stuff goes wrong. And that's what happens in life too. But the more you can be resilient to it and just realize that you're just part of the computer program, a sense organ of the infinite, if you like, rather than an individual entity. And the more you get rid of stresses, the more you're naturally led towards a realization of that. It's as the stresses disappear, we just know that. We know that. We come back to the knowledge of that. It's something we've forgotten. It's not something we've got to learn or gain. It's something that kind of happens again. So that's the biggest reason why arthritis was the best thing that ever happened to me, was because it led me further to a realization of that than any spiritual practice while in good health ever did. And then you realize that everything, just living, just everything we do from moment to moment is a spiritual practice. There is no something to strive for, this constant dissatisfaction of the spiritual seeker. Spirituality has its place, meditation, wonderful. It does all kinds of wonderful things. But when you're actively seeking, it's just another way to make you dissatisfied. It's about relaxing into the present. Eckhart Tolle was pretty cool with his stuff. Don't give out any techniques. Just shout at everyone about the present. And yeah, very useful stuff. Difficult to grasp when you're in the midst of a whirling autoimmune condition. But where it can lead you, if anybody's listening to this who is diagnosed recently and they're in great pain or whatever, all I can say is that it could be a massive blessing in disguise. So chill out, set out on that journey, and you know, you could discover some wonderful miracles.
Well, Phil, today we've been discussing many of the ideas brought up in your book. As you mentioned, arthritis, the best thing that ever happened to me. That's widely available, but tell folks about that if you wish. Share a website or websites if you have them, and just anything else you'd like to put out there.
Oh, cool. Yes, well, my main website is pureactivity1word.net. And I've got Facebook pages and Twitter and whatever. And the book is available. The book's on Amazon Kindle. And that's available. You can get that to download straight away. And, you know, if anybody does fancy chatting, I do Skype consultations and things. It's such a privilege to talk to people and to hear their success stories. And I learn so much from them too. So, yes. Do get in touch if you like, or yes, the book's there, or anyway, good luck with your own healing, anybody who's listening to this, because it's in your own hands, really. Develop your own intuition and heal.
Splendid. Well, Phil, thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Well, thank you so much, Greg. It's been a great chat.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's legalize-freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.